Okay, today is April 14th. We are taping Bible in the Ancient Near East. And we're talking today about Bava Mahateras, which is the beginning of Perikop Beis Ushmos. Okay, that's how the Gemara refers to it. Okay. That's the very beginning of a Perikop. Bava Mahateras, you might say, Habanov. If the Ganav is found to be burrowing into someone's home, Vihukav a mace, and he is beaten to the point of being killed, Ein lo damim, we discussed who the law was talking about in the last class, right? Okay? So, right? Vihukav a mace means that while usually, when someone is threatening you, right, and you have to use some force in order to protect yourselves, right, you have to use some degree of force. If the judges determine that you use too much force, that you could have saved yourself by just taking out his leg. I mean, even the soldiers, especially in Israel, you know, they're up to more scrutiny than any place else in the world. Are always up to this scrutiny. How much disproportional force, you know, disproportional reaction. So, but when someone comes into your home, especially when there are no witnesses, someone comes into your home, you have the right to do anything you can to protect yourself. There's a famous defense in New York City in the 70s called the Bernie Goetz defense. Have you heard of this? I remember it because I lived through the 70s. So, someone who was on a train, and trains were really hotbeds of crime at the time. This is in the mid to late 70s. And someone put a screwdriver in front of a man's face and said, "Give me $5. Right? It's an experience everyone went through in New York. Right? But this guy had a gun on him. And he proceeded to shoot every one of them. Right? And one, he kept shooting again and again, the guy with the screwdriver in his hand. Didn't end up killing him, but he crippled him. Right? So, of course, he was caught at the next stop, and his defense was that here in New York, they'll kill you for anything. They kill you for stepping on your foot. They'll kill you for, right? I was not using disproportionate force or lethal force, but I didn't have to. Those guys would have killed me if I didn't start shooting them. Alright? And he got off. He got off on that. It was a successful defense. Alright? Someone who comes in and breaks into your house, you know, you don't have to defend yourself at all. Right? Now again, if there are no witnesses, you know, you can make up any story you want in your own defense. But let's say you have there's a video camera that can determine what actually happened. And the judge determines that this man did not pose a life-threatening threat to you. How should you know? Okay, there you go. That's what I was waiting to hear from you. How can you know that? You can tap him on the shoulder and say, "What are your plans?" Right? And what if it's very clear, and then this is obvious, that the only threat to you is your property? Because I'm sure he would love nothing more than to just have free reign to your brake front, take out all your silver and go without incident. Right? So the Torah is saying here, Rukavah may say, "No damim, I'm sorry. We're not asking any questions. The Torah doesn't tell us any circumstance." And we have good Torah Shabbat on this, right? As usual, how can we know what the circumstance is here without everything that has to come between the lines? Gemara says that the burden is on the person breaking into your house, not upon you. You have to assume, you're allowed to assume, you would want to assume, his worst intention, right? You follow? Okay, but the Gemara allows for just one circumstance. If you know the Gemara, you'll know it. One circumstance we're not allowed to kill. Can you think? Good. Vizorcha HaShemesh. Let's go read on, continue. Because ancient law does at some points differentiate between day and night on this. We ended last class with this discussion. Should we differentiate between whether this is done by day or whether this is done by night? Logic indicates yes. If someone breaks into your home, what's the basic difference between when he does it during the day and when he does it at night? Okay, that's one thing. Mara doesn't discuss
that. He assumes no one is home during the day.
Yes. It's a greater assumption that when you break into someone's home at night, someone is going to be home and therefore may confront you. And if that person confronts you, right? Now, I don't know what's on the mind of the guy who's breaking into my house. I know what's on my mind. And my mind is, I am allowed to assume the worst. That if I do make a stand for my money, he's going to shoot me and run away. He doesn't want to get caught. Right? So he's going to shoot me. This is the source in Shas. You've heard of this statement. When someone is posing a lethal threat to you, get up and kill him first before he has a chance to kill you. Right? By the way, the halacha is like that. Even someone else, you have the right to kill that person. Right? Not only that, you should. Right? Okay, so surely if he's coming to threaten me, I have the right to take him out. But how do you know he's threatening you? He's threatening your kiddush cups. He's not threatening you. So the answer is, the Torah is saying, a man has the right to make a stand for his money. For his damin. Someone in the class pointed out the pun. Chazal called damin money. You get it? Alright, but that's too much of a drash, because especially since it says ain't no damin. Anyway, so that's the first differentiation between day and night. Someone here said about whether you can see or not, because the Gemara makes such a drash. And this machlok is the Rambam and the Rambam private, whether that drash is appropriate l'maisa. Because during the day, you can, especially if this is a metaphor, you can more readily discern his intention. At night, you can't. And the Gemara says, wait, how can you know? It's doubtful. So remember, what does the Gemara say? Only one instance. Can you assume he's not going to kill you?
If it's your father.
If it's your father, and that's the only thing. If it's your father or mother. But not if it's your son. It's your son. Your son may kill you if you make a stand. What's my son doing breaking into my house? Right? Now, a father may say, okay, look, he's going to inherit me anyway. Why does he have to steal it? But still, the Gemara says the only one who won't kill you is your father. Look, Avshalom was ready to kill his father. Right? Your father won't kill you. Remember, David commanded everybody at the battle. Remember what he said? Bring him back alive. Don't touch my son. He's trying to kill you. I'm a lawgiver. But he's my son. I'm not going to ashkan bar gay. Right? So Gemara uses that logic and says that's the only instance. Right? Even if he's wearing a sign that says, I'm only coming here for your kiddush cups. I'm not going to kill anybody. I'm not even armed. Yeah, it's crazy. Burden is on the guy breaking into your house, right? Okay, so to differentiate mamash across the board between day and night is on the following assumption. Either we read it figuratively, that day is a metaphor for something. I would never read any ancient code with metaphors, but I reserve the right to read the Torah with metaphors because it's my document. That's how the rabbis tell me to read it. To wit, for instance, the Torah in Kisetze says, excuse this digression, but stay with me. The Torah says, if a woman is raped in the field, right, treat her X, Y, and Z in such and such a way. If she's raped in the city, then she is guilty because she should have screamed out. Right? But if she's raped in the field, so ikve ein moshiyah. I'm talking about an engaged nara marosa. But if she's engaged, if she's raped in the field, she's innocent no matter what. Because it's a ikve ein moshiyah. That's what we learned, that if she does scream and you hear her, you should save her. Kill the guy. Not only can you kill someone who's threatening someone's life, you can kill someone who's threatening someone with arayos. That's how the Gemara learned this. Right? Okay. So wait, but you she in the field, but if she's raped in the city, she's guilty. She should have screamed out. And the Gemara says, that's impossible. That's impossible that a woman, man, is covered with masks and you scream, I'll kill you. And if it's in the city, she shouldn't scream. Presumably. So that the whole difference is between the city and the field? No, says the Gemara. It's a metaphor. That this being in the field is a sign of her unclear unwillingness. The city is, if we can prove it, well, it's never in all of history of mankind never been proved such. The woman is always going to stay, even if she was willing partner in this. She's going to say, I wasn't, if there are no witnesses. Right? You know what I'm saying? Following? So, Eve Moshiela, it doesn't mean that we categorically differentiate between whether this unfortunate event took place in the field or in the city. No, it's just a metaphor for how we can determine that she did this willingly. Okay, you with me? Now I'll get back to our case. Day and night, according to this first interpretation, it doesn't break between when the sun is shining and when the sun isn't shining. Right? Day and night is just a metaphor for how sure the man who hears that someone's rummaging through his brake front, right, how sure he is about the intentions of this man. It's just unusual that the only case of day is your father. Night is everything else. Because night is a time of murkiness. I'm not sure. It's dark. I can't tell intentions. And in Parshat Shach, when the son is like, oh, look who's coming into my house. It's my classmate. Right? Someone I know. Anyone but your father, you have the right to kill. Now, you don't have the chiyuv to kill him. Of course not. You have the right to kill him. And as the longest we said last class, even on Shabbos. Because he ate, doesn't have blood. Okay. So we're going to... And by the way, I think we gave an example at the very end of last class, maybe only with a few of you remaining behind, is that in most laws, certainly in probably it's determined by the states, but in this country, there's a very famous difference in your punishment, whether you did this crime by day or whether you did this crime by night. Can you think of something?
Arson.
If I torch someone's house as a punishment, you didn't pay back your loan shark or whatever it is, and I torch someone's house by day, and someone is killed, that's called murder two. If I torch someone's house by night and someone is killed by that, and I'm shown to have, you know, gasoline and lit the fire at night, that is considered murder one, murder with intent, because you have to imagine that someone is home at night. Now it's a factory or someplace at night, and one guy was staying late, and yeah, you know, all right, that might not that also might not be it's a factory at night. Usually, I don't expect someone to be there. Maybe a factory, you'll treat arson differently because it's during the day, right? Because or a storefront or something. Like torch, and the guys are working prisoners in a store. I assume that they're there during the day, but not at night. Found the difference? When it comes to arson, the law will treat you differently when you do this by day and by night. Most laws are going to be the same 24 hours a day, but we do understand that there should be some things different, treated differently based on the assumption of where is this crime going. Yes?
So the metaphorical interpretation of this would be... It's not like always, like if it's during the day, we categorically say that you're not allowed to necessarily kill him, but we just say that during the day there's a greater assumption that the robber would have not assumed that somebody was home. So
the day is a metaphor for your clarity of what you understand to be as the case, which might be that we'll flip this on a factory that's in Long Island City at night. Following or at night, the assumption is that there's no one there. At day, the assumption is that the people working in it. Okay. So take a look at page 86. All right. So since this is within the context. In Perek Chaf Beis, So we already had a fourfold and a fivefold compensation for sheep and cattle, right? If he can't pay back, then he's sold into slavery. Right? You have some ancient codes that say, we talked about this already, if you can't pay back, you're killed. It mentions four different ancient law codes that have the death penalty if you can't pay back what you stole. Right? Page 86, he says, life and property remain incommensurable. In the biblical corpora, no offense against property is punishable by death. And no offense by your property is punishable by death. That, I must tell you, were dependent on Torah Shabbat. Again, it's a slight digression. The Torah says that if your ox kills a human being, right, and you were warned this is a dangerous ox, and it kills again, it says, Gam be'olav you must. Because the punishment for an ox that kills even once is the death penalty. How did you put the ox? You're supposed to kill the ox. How did you not take care of your ox? You've got to put this ox down, right? And you let him kill again? The Torah says, if such a disregard for your community, such a disregard for you, for what this ox does. So it says, Gam be'olav you must. Gam be'olav you must. And you must means shall be put to death. If it had said Yamus, then I'd say, alright, it means God will take care of him. He'll die. He'll die. But you must means he shall be put to death, which usually means by a man's hand. But the Talmud is this very, very sort of tied up with this. Talmud just says, because again, you see the difference between Yamus and you must? Yamus I can handle. So you must, the Gemara says, just put this man in Chayim. You know, don't let anybody sell him things. He doesn't be on his own. And if this guy is so wretched that he let his animal kill after a warning, right, where he should have put the animal down. So, right, you can't put him to death, mamish, because we don't put to death for what your property does, only what you do with intent. Right? It's depraved. Right? Incidentally, it's not even that you might have thought that for such a case, maybe we'll let the blood avengers get at him, right? The relatives of this poor kid that he killed. Right? It's interesting, when it talks about this ox killing again, it says, or if he kills a boy, or if he kills a girl. Remember I asked this question sometime before? Why does it say if the slave has a boy or a girl, he stays with... Usually the Torah just writes a child. Right? Well, sometimes, however, it says a boy or a girl. If the ox gores a boy, or if the ox gores a girl. Why would I think of such a thing? Just say, if the ox gores a child. So, for one, a child is usually going to be more susceptible to such a wild ox. A human being, an adult, will recognize. But it's interesting is that Chantal says something interesting. He says, boys are more mischievous than girls. And you might have thought that the boy pulled his tail or threw rocks at it and did something to deserve the ox getting upset and killing him. And therefore, you might have treated a boy and a girl differently about an ox killing it. Kamash Mulan Torah says, don't. To be treated the same. Well, very interesting thing, but we Shadal saw 8-year-old boys and girls about what they might do to an ox. Okay, but back to our section here, is that what your property does is no death penalty, very widespread in the ancient world, about digging a pit and someone falls in and dies, the person who digs the pit is to be killed. The Torah in Parshas Mishpatim establishes the Bava Kamma at its side, that nothing your property does, or anything you did inadvertently or indirectly, can cause the death penalty. Right? No expropriation of any property will cause the death penalty. Not the property of another person, not the property of God. Most ancient codes, if you steal from the temple, you need to be hung up by your toes. Right? What's the Torah's law about stealing from the temple? It's called Me'ilah. From the Mishkan, it's you have to bring a korban back to the temple. Right? Okay, you with me? So the Torah is setting a very interesting. Some things are profoundly machmir on all the entire corpus of ancient law, such as parents, remember, kidnapping, right? But most of it is profoundly mater, right? Because there's a whole host of death penalties for what your property does, right? And what your and death penalties for stealing property if you can't pay it back, right? Right here on page 86, if you listen to 1, 2, 3, 4 ancient codes that have the right.
You said Chazal said that there's no death penalty for anything with property. Didn't the Torah just say that there was? Didn't you start off by saying that there is?
Was you stealing property?
No, it's keeping up your ox.
So it says Gamba Allah, you must. So that's why I said the Gemara's hands are a bit tied because they means that the owner ought to die. Even entering this parish to the Pasuk says there's nothing within the corpus of Torah about that it says the person is put to death for what his property does. So how do we understand Gamba Allah, you must? Means this owner he should be so cast away by the community that not that he's going to die because he has no food to eat, but treat him like a pariah who deserves to be treated so that his life will be shortened somehow. But the courts cannot put him someone to death for something who's private. So we're left with mostly a parshanut question. Why would the Torah write, Gamba Allah, you must?
Sorry,
yes. No, it says earlier you must. And it says Gamba Allah you must. So owner also shall be. Okay? So let's see. Now the Pasuk says, to get back to the beginning of Chof Beis, Im Bamachteres Yimotsei Haganov. What does Yimotsei mean? Im Bamachteres Yimotsei. It's an unusual term. Well, it's passage. So
found.
It's found, okay. In what way? In other words, I found on the video screen upstairs where I have 9 different boxes of different places in the house, and it's that a man with a ski cap on, and he's rummaging through my real living room. Right? Is that you must say? Let's see what Tara Mungulis does. In Bamachtarta Yishtikach. Yishtikach means he's found to be, confronted. He may know that you know about him, he may not know. You're looking through the slats of your staircase going down, and you see, look at that, he's in my dining room, he's taking out all my silver. Right? Okay, so what Sean Paul does, take a look on page 86, he says, if the thief is seized, you must say means caught him already. While tunneling and he is beaten to death, there is no blood guilt. Okay. There is no blood guilt in his case. If the sun has risen on him, there is blood guilt in that case. Right? In the machteres yimotzei haganav, v'hu kav ha'meis ein lo damim. In zarach ha'shemesh alav, damim lo.
You're saying after he's done, you know, he's stolen stuff, he
has. Right, the sun has risen on him.
Or in the end.
Right, he's active. Within the section pertaining to the theft of livestock, which are normally kept outside the house, a law on larceny is interpolated, which pertains to attempted theft of property from within the house. Okay. Right, I'm just going to read a little more on page 87. When there is any presumption of danger to the life of the house owner, he is permitted to protect himself even at the expense of the life of the housebreaker. Thus, if the offense takes place at night, when there is chance that the housebreaker might have resorted to homicide, and the housebreaker is slain, this is considered a case of self-defense. That is very simple, that's the mark.
But we say that he could still kill him, even though, even if we know that the robber had no intention of killing him, even if he was just.
Well, hold it. The robber just said that the only case is that's your fault. Every other case, it's not your burden to tap him on the shoulder and say what you intend to do here.
But even if he's just rummaging through the silver and he's going to take the silver, I thought we said that that he'd still be
able. Right, but so we said that the person is. This is considered a case of self-defense on the part of the owner of the house and falls within the category of justifiable homicide. Right, so let me move on. The guy breaking into your house would want nothing more than for you to just stay under your bed and let him finish up his job and move on to the next house. Such is not the case, however, if the offense takes place during the day when the owner of the house may not protect his property at the expense of the life of the housebreaker, who it is assumed came only to rob and not to commit homicide. Hence, if the housebreaker is slain, the house owner incurs blood guilt. And this is a simple interpretation of Pshat. But it's not the interpretation of Chazal. Although I must tell you this, it's a machlokis, the Rambam and the Raivin, whether day and night is to be understood as a metaphor or not, because it's a machlokis in the Gemara. Right. Okay. And now this is what Paul does so well. He shows you that the other law codes, the Bagishtar, also makes a distinction between unlawful entry by day and by night. He says a man who is caught in the house inside the building at high noon shall pay 10 shekels of silver. He who is caught inside the building at night shall die. He shall not live. There you go. Don't break into someone's house at night. Now, what does shall die mean here? Profound difference between the Bedishtar and the Halacha. Because who's the one killing this robber?
You.
As is you. If you apprehend him and tie him up and say, this man was breaking into my house, and I caught him, right? He has to pay the price, the fine that the Torah says, kefil. He's got to pay double. But according to the Egyptian code, if he's caught at night by the police, by the owner, or anyone else, he's going to be killed. The halacha only allows the killing of this housebreaker in the heat of a confrontation by the owner of a house. Follow what I'm saying? If he is apprehended, tied up, and let the law take its place, right? Following? No one's going to say this man is killed for stealing. The regular laws of stealing kicks in. If he stole livestock, he's got to pay 4 or 5. If he stole property, he's got to pay double. You following here? So here is a this very important point. We have 10 more minutes in the class, but here's a very important point. What we see very often in ancient codes is let the property owner and people take things into their own hands. Right? What we see what we mean is that if someone breaks into your house and he trips and breaks his leg, and he's rendered incapable of escaping, he's, Take, keep your stuff. You can kill him. The halacha, I'm just making up this case now. I haven't seen it covered in the Gemara. The stomach would be usher to kill that man in such a case. He's already been taken out. Or he trips over a wire and he electrocutes himself, and he's knocked out. You know, I guess if there are no witnesses, anyone will believe whatever the guy says. But if he kills the man, he knows he has blood on his hands. Right? Tie him up. Right? Okay, I'll admit that Torah does allow taking things into your own hands when it comes to your mitzvot. Right? That's just meant to be an incentive of the guy who killed. If you took a life, what's your best way to be protected from the blood avengers? Is to try to convince the court that you did it by accident, not by mistake. Right? And while it's very easy to learn Maseches Makos with great all the proportion of the world, Lamaisa, when it came down to Lamaisa, Halacha Lamaisa, a case that actually comes up, right? The proportion will say that you know, it's sometimes just a little quibbling to determine whether it was an accident or a mistake. And, you know, unless it keeps happening, right? It's you're going to be able to convince a jury or Beis Din, it's Beis Din of 23, that we'd like to keep justice as much as possible out of the hands of vigilantes, of people themselves, right? We want justice to be promulgated by the courts. So that when the Torah talks about Ben Sorer or Boreh, what does it say that the parents should do? Take the child to the Beis Din and let them know what he's been doing. And then the Gemara says, when we get through with your case, remember the Gemara says, this is actually the main point. Everything else is a tangent to this. The Gemara says, take him to court and we'll show that we're going to philosophize or we're going to darshan our way out of the child being killed. Why? Because you took it to court, right? As opposed to practically every ancient code that allows the parents to kill rebellious children at home. Preferably in front of your other children, right? It's very interesting because that very, probably very well-known rule for the Jews leaving Egypt manifests itself at the end of the Ben Sorer Umora psukim that talks about killing this boy. It's only four psukim. And it says, let everyone else look, watch, and learn their lesson. That's exactly what you do. If you're in Sumeria and you have a child that you just cannot discipline, you just kill the child in front of everybody else. It might be a little painful, but I have other children to worry about. You kill the child in front of everybody else, and he goes, remember, what happens if you behave like that? Right? So that gets it made its way into the Torah too. Right? What's interesting is, and that's the beauty of learning a system, you see, what's written in here has been studied just tremendously for the last, let's say in Torah Sheba'al Peh, 2,000 years, but I assume it's been studied since it was given without being written down. Torah Sheba'al Peh was only written down in the Mishnah. And we have an evolution of the messages, the way the Talmud and its commentaries explain what we're doing to the Ben Sorer Mora is mussar to the parents. Get that? It's mussar to the parents. How did you let a kid get to this stage? Right? It's interesting. The Gemara in Kiddushin says, how old are you supposed to get married? The Gemara says, because the Gemara in Kiddushin says you should teach your child a trade, Torah, how to swim, and how to get married. So the first three are pretty easy to put your finger on, right? Trade is a trade, is swim, I know swimming, you know. But how do you teach your child to get married? How do you do that? So after the Gemara gives us some snippets, and then the Farshim discuss what you're supposed to do. But it says, make sure that you marry your son off by the age of 16. Girls are married at 12 already. Right? Make sure you marry your son off no later than 16. What happens after 16? Does the Gemara say? They won't listen to you anymore. After 16, they say, I'm on my own. I'm, you know, why they chose that age? It's just, you know. Okay. Since we're getting close to Pesach, I share with you a beautiful board about who the four sons are at the Seder. You know who the four sons are? They're all of us. We start off Shener De'elishol. Then we become Tom, Mazeh, 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 Mazeh. Then we become Rasha. We go through a rebellious stage. Everyone does. Right? And then, hopefully, with the life experiences, you become a Chacham. Right? You go backwards in the four. So that the Ben Sorer Mora is In Sumeria, in Egypt, in Babylonia, you have a rebellious son. Just kill him in front of everyone else. Right? I care about what's the, you know, practical issues about the other kids, and I want to raise them well. Right? Torah, at least as it manifests itself in Torah Shabbat Peh. Say there's no such thing. Remember the Lashon of the Gemara? There's no such thing. Remember the few cases the Gemara says? The big parshios in the Torah. One is this week's parsha. Right? Remember the other two? Yerem Yidachas. The can't be. Destroy a whole city because everyone in the city worships the Zohar. Not because we don't like what's written in the Torah and I want to say it doesn't exist. But because the conditions placed on the city to become an Yerem Yidachas by the drushes of the Gemara are so remote that it's inconceivable that it could ever become. So why write it? Where is it? Drush v'kabel schar. Ben Sor Morat, Ben Yerem Yidachas, the third is Pasha, he gave Batim a house to be destroyed because it has leprosy. A big part of this, a lot of Sukkim in this week's Pasha on that. The Gemara says, no, it can never happen. Anyway, this is in a practical sense. Okay. So this is an important point. Right. Let's continue.
What does Imatzei mean?
So Imatzei is that he is not only found, but you did something with him. Imatzei means you confronted him. Because you must say can mean that you're just seeing him through the slats of your staircase. Right? But that you do actually confront him, whether by accident or by mistake or intentional. I think that the rendition, if the thief is seized, which is what he writes here, Berta Kasuta, I think it works. Let's just read a little further. Right? The Benishtar also makes a distinction between unlawful entry by day and by night. Right, we talked about that. Right? But they differ, in Exodus still differs, but nevertheless in regard to one basic principle. Whereas cuneiform law prescribes capital punishment for such a crime against property, Exodus merely permits the slaying of the housekeeper. It does not designate this as a prescribed punishment. Okay? Pashup shot, right? Once again, it is to be noted that no crime against property per se, even the presumption of theft, warrants capital punishment. To a Sumerian, your silver is a piece of property. A human life is a piece of property. Your value as a human being is only insofar as what do you do for this city to assure that the gods continue to make us successful and our crops grow properly and we win our next war, right? That's your value, right? It's somewhat religious, I understand, but it's your value. Okay? In the Torah, we'll see that if you break down every difference between cuneiform law and the Torah, you'll see that it all breaks down to the human being is in God's image. In our system, and you have some other value in terms of your society and the other law. Okay? But today, to wrap up today, that manifests itself in two things. One is that you can never be killed for a crime against property. The only reason why we allow this homeowner to make a stand for himself is because of the give and take of Habol HaHor B'chashkei Margehu. And your property causing damage, either with a pit or an ox story or other things like that, cannot lead to a death penalty. What is left for us to explain is that difficult pasuk that says that the ox roared more than once and killed more than once, and gamba alav you must. We're a little lost, and it must mean that since the halacha does not ever take it that way. So when we look at Ibn Ezra, we look at the Pshat Mefarshim, and they say he ought to die. Right? Again, I wouldn't have such a problem if it said Gamba love you mus. Gamba love you must seems to be reserved for being put to death. Right? God punishes one for the sin of another. But Ish Bechato you must do. No one's to be put to death for the sin of another. Which was also very common, known as vicarious punishment. Okay.